Welcome to the Scariest Things Podcast, episode number 20. Woo! Scariest Things is your gateway to the tropes and trends of the horror genre. My name is Mike Campbell, and I've been at this for 20 episodes, and with me I have...
Eric Lee, fresh
also,
from New Orleans.
Also been at it for 20 episodes, but before we jump into tonight's episode, which tonight we're talking about the scariest soundtracks of all time... I want you, Eric, I'm going to put you on the spot. You just came back from the Overlook Film Festival quickly, super quickly, because you can go to the Scariest Things website and listen to Eric's hot take on the Overlook Film Festival. Give me your top three coolest things you did, saw, ate, were a part of, met at the Overlook Film Festival
in
New Orleans.
Oh, how do I?
1, 2, 3, go.
Okay.
1, 2, 3, go.
I have a new favorite sandwich.
Which is?
It's a fried bologna sandwich from Turkey and the Wolf. It is, it's a French brioche bread, fried bologna, cheese sauce, coleslaw, honey mustard, potato chips.
And it is not made out of human flesh.
It is not, but if it was, I'd still name it as my favorite sandwich of all time. New favorite sandwich.
Number three. Number two
was actually getting a chance to see an advanced screening of Hereditary. And folks, this is the real shit. I think there's been a mountain of hype that's built up over that film from Sundance and from South by Southwest. The hype is real.
Eric is comparing it to The Exorcist.
It is very much like The Exorcist.
Tune in July?
June 6th.
Tune in June, yeah. Early June, mid-June. Yeah. We might be talking Hereditary. Yeah.
It's Exorcist or also Babadook on steroids.
Okay, so, I like it. Okay, number one.
Number one was actually meeting all the people down in New Orleans at this convention, actually getting a chance to meet with the director of St. Agatha, Darren Lynn Bousman, who is also the director of Saws 1, 2, 3, and Abattoir.
No, 2, 3, and 4.
2, 3, and 4.
2, 3, and 4.
And
you can listen to a short interview, very short, 10-minute interview with Darren Bousman on the Scariest Things podcast.
He's a great guy. And there are so many of you realize that the horror crowd is a small insular family. These producers and directors and actors need the fans as much as we need them. And I think that kind of community spirit really, you could feel it at something like The Overlook. So if you're a horror movie fan, and if you're listening to this podcast, I know you are, I'm hoping to see you guys there next year. And I think I might have picked up a few friends who I met at The Overlook Film Festival who are listening in now. So, hey guys, how you doing?
Bologna sandwiches, Hereditary, and The People.
The people.
Doing it for the people. All right. So, good recap. I'm excited. Equal parts excited and jealous.
Yeah. Next time.
That's where I'm leaving it because I didn't get to go, but next year I'm going. Or I'll maybe go to a B-movie horror. Maybe not The Overlook. Maybe I'll find something else.
Actually, I think the Overlook really feels like it's not... They bring quality product, and it's a small enough venue that you can see a lot of really cool stuff. There's not a lot of chuff in that festival. I highly recommend
Chud.
No Chud.
They did not show the remake of Chud. All right, so tonight we're talking about scary soundtracks.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a couple questions to pose to you.
You betcha.
Can music make the film? Question number one.
Jaws.
Well, yeah, that's a good point.
Exorcist.
Right. Sure.
Halloween.
Tubular Bells.
Yeah. Tubular Bells
was never meant as a scary song. Interestingly.
No. But
it is pretty damn scary. It cannot escape being scary.
It's scary by association.
Oh, but, sure. 100%.
But Jaws.
Yeah.
Is straight up scary. You're being hunted. Music. And spoiler alert, I didn't put Jaws on my list because I figure it's obvious.
Everyone has heard Jaws.
I think part of my goal here is to come up with some of my favorite ones and see if Mike says if they are so identifiable that Mike can pick out what it is.
And vice versa. All right, so question number two. This is the tough one. Strings, piano, or synthesizer? And you can't say a mix of all three.
Oh, well, come
like,
on.
What do you think? What do you think is like the what is the sound that sort of like to you triggers that horrible response, puts the hairs on your arms standing straight up?
Well, I think the way that composers use strings to do the jump scares.
Yeah.
I think they'll build it up with the bass and the cello or the low brass, and then they hit you with the shrieking strings for the jump scares. And that, I think emotionally, that can't help but catch you. I mean,
so no love for John Carpenter is what I'm saying.
Well, that's
the take home.
You boxed me in a corner, dude.
Love for John Carpenter.
I have.
This is the saddest saddest episode we've done so
plinky,
far.
Plinky Casio keyboard isn't inherently scary. But you will see, I think, that I've picked out from every generation of horror movies, I think that there's iterations that you associate with an era of horror movies.
Yeah, that's true.
And so, and some of these kinds of things have come and gone, and we'll get the chance to discuss the trends of soundtracks. So
I think we will. Yeah. Okay. Well, without further ado, let's get into it. Starting with number four on Eric's Fearsome Foursome list.
Okay. All right. So as
number four.
Number four is we're going old school here, and this is a well-worn. I think this screams monster movie, and I want to see if you can figure out which one this is. No peeking. I know it's on my pad. All right.
Okay. How long do I get for this? I get like an hour.
Quick hit. What do you think it is?
Attack of the 50-Foot Woman.
This is It Came from Beneath the Sea.
Ah.
1955. So I think
it came from beneath the sea.
It came from beneath the sea. This is a big horns, big brassy kind of. You listen to it and you know it's a monster movie.
You can
sense the tentacles pulling down the Golden Gate Bridge. This is a there's a bunch of other ones. Them had a great soundtrack. Mm-hmm. The Spider, which had these kind of the kind of whiny, kind of the spacey sci-fi kind of a bit to it, and The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms. Those are all great.
Am I wrong, or did some of those songs that from all those monster movies, and this could just be complete revisionist history or a repressed memory or some horrible cocktail of the both, but did some of those songs make it into multiple films? There's a couple of those songs, I swear to God, they just picked it up. Yeah. And it might have just been the studio. It might have been Paramount. It might have been Columbia. They said, oh, that worked for Attack of the 50-Foot Woman.
Yeah.
Apply it to Them. That worked for that. Apply it to Black Tarantula.
I think that the way that these happen is that they all riff on the similar themes. I think that if you're trying to tie it back to classical music, this is Mussorgsky's Night on Bald Mountain.
Mm-hmm.
Bum, bum,
bum.
You know, that classic sort of dramatic thing that you see in Fantasia, those are the kind of riffs that you get out of the classic monster movies from the 50s. They do sound similar, and that's why. But I think the most iconic one of the bunch for me is It Came from Beneath the Sea. It has that weight to it.
And, it does, yep.
And
for sure.
This is Misha Balinkhanikov.
Misha
Balakhnikov, say it five times fast and like
can't. Misha Balakhnikov.
So yeah, you get the big strings. The one thing that you get in these kinds of soundtracks in the monster movies in the 50s is you get kettle drums.
Right.
Boom, 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 boom.
Right.
You get the and so it because what they're trying to do is they're trying to get this behemoth of a monster, and they want that the heaviness of it. And so that's what I really love about these old 50s monster movies.
I like it. I like
Michael,
it.
What's your number four?
My number four, I'm gonna throw a curveball to Eric here, and we're going to see if Eric can guess my number four on the Fearsome Foursome list.
I'm not sure yet.
guess? You got a guess? Come on now. We talked about this film. And time is up. Time is up. This is a film we talked about. We talked about it in the context of our zombie episode, which was episode four?
Zombie?
This is Zombie 2.
Okay.
The sort of sequel to the Italian release of Dawn of the Dead. It includes maybe, one of the most iconic, one of the most memorable sort of synth, again, a nod to the synthesizer, sort of the synth horror master Lucio Fulci and his collaborator Fabio Frizzi.
What a name.
Fabio Frizzi. The soundtrack is like, it is a whole crazy different hodgepodge of like, there's some exotica, there's some like weird noisy electronic stuff. There's some disco, there's some marimba, there's some drumming, there's some chanting, you know, because eventually they follow the zombie to the deserted island. But the original song to Zombie 2 is, I think it's one of the most iconic songs in all of horror.
It almost sounds like it's zombies marching.
It does. It does. That's a good observation, because not unlike the whole concept of the kettle drum and playing very loud to sort of introduce the monster. Mm-hmm. I mean, that has that sort of like,
it's kind of a slow, crunchy kind of slowly advancing.
Yeah, it's got this electronic prod, this drone of these undead creatures approaching the city. So, I wouldn't say go out and get the entire zombie soundtrack, but, you know, it wouldn't kill you if you just listen to a little zombie, or at the very least, the zombie theme. That's a good place to start. All right, so Eric, what do you have for me next? This would be number
three
on your fearsome foursome list.
Okay, this is a classic.
Okay, let me think. Let me noodle this for a second. It's a choir.
It is a choir.
It's vaguely satanic. It's a little ominous. It might be about satanic children. I don't know for sure.
Yeah,
Let's let it build. I'll get to the best part. Okay, this is good.
Yep.
This is good. We have a, we have an overlap.
So
this might be the scariest episode. We've actually brought music to. This might be the scariest episode. I'm gonna say it.
Are you spooked? This is, of course, Jerry Goldsmith's orchestration of The Omen.
Yes,
his 1976 Oscar-winning.
Won an Oscar.
It won an Oscar. It is
all right.
It is a.
Which I'll bet if you go back and look at scariestthings.com, the website, and you look at Eric's Oscar, like, opus Oscar breakdown, you will see probably a nod to The Omen.
Yeah, and I think obviously it was well respected, but I think it's rich and it's textured. It's got when the Glockenspiel comes in chiming like church bells. But over the top of this deep Gregorian kind of chanting in Latin, it really sets the mood, and it is explicitly for. And I think it also set the table. It set the bar very, very high for similar kind of culty kind of movies.
And the opening song that we heard a little bit of is called Ave Satana.
Yeah,
naturally, which is called Hail Satan. That is the translation. Hail Satan, Ave Satana.
So yeah, I kind of half suspected that we were going to run into each other. Mike being the lover of all things 70s horror, and this is the high water mark for sort of production values, scary, ominous. It took full advantage of the success of The Exorcist.
Right. Oh yeah, for sure.
And
Although it took it into I think it took horror soundtracks into a radically different place than did The Exorcist.
Oh, absolutely.
I think Mike Oldfield's Tubular Bells was just I think he just stumbled on that. I don't think there was ever any intention to create a truly scary soundtrack.
No, and this one when you know, does it set the mood? Of course it sets the mood.
Oh yeah.
If you said, what kind of a movie are you guys watching? And you play that, it's like, scary movie.
Oh, yeah. You know, and in fact, Jerry Goldsmith had been nominated 8 times previously.
Was this his first win?
8 times previously with Zippo. Yeah. Nothing.
So and good on you, Jerry.
And then he won for The Omen, and he apparently had said that he was incredibly surprised because he just flat out didn't think it was the kind of film the Academy would even go for.
Yeah, I think it was...
So again, dumb luck on Mike Oldfield's part and dumb luck on... No, not dumb luck. There was some serious chops there.
Yeah, I think that with horror movies, there's a struggle to get a full orchestration, I think, just to be able to get the kind of a budget that will allow for an orchestral score.
Oh, yeah.
I think it's hard, and that's why, not to put too fine a point on it, but this is why you get Casio keyboard John Carpenter a lot.
Hey, now, come on, slow down.
All right,
slow down. Let's give John Carpenter a little love.
So, Mr. Campbell.
All right,
you're number three. Let's see.
My number three on the Fearsome Foursome list. Let's see if you can guess what this is.
I'm almost certain I know one of these is going to be. Bet you I know what your number one is, but let's go with number three.
Whatever. All right. All right. Let's see if you can guess what this one is. Takes a second to get into it.
Okay.
Maybe two. Maybe 2 seconds.
This Phantasm?
Oh, he got it!
I got it! Yeah, baby, yeah. Right there.
Very nice. Very nice. Yes, of course we were talking, and we have talked a lot about Phantasm in many different contexts, I think. Yep. But Phantasm is, an exceptional film in many different regards. I think we've talked about this in the context of, Angus Scrimm being one of the best horror characters. We've talked about it in the context of being one of the best sci-fi horror films. We've covered many different elements of Phantasm. The two guys that did this soundtrack, Fred Myro and Malcolm Seagrave, were both classically trained composers, allegedly. Mm-hmm. And they decided that they each had a bunch of different influences to bring in, and they had a bunch of different musical fortes, and so they just decided to throw it all together. And this is an incredible. I always felt like this was a very, very sinister, very, very sinister sound, and that's why I was sort of asking the question earlier, like strings, piano.
Yeah.
Keyboard. I think this gets you more.
Both. I mean, you get the synthesizer and you get the piano.
Yeah.
I think that one of the things that I associate the Phantasm soundtrack with is it is influenced by the Halloween soundtrack. The real clear.
Oh, yeah, they were hot on the heels, right? Because Halloween was 78, this was 79.
Yeah.
So, yeah, they were hot on the heels of each other, for sure.
I think that they're cousins relative to their soundtracks, but they also, I think there's something. And I'm not sure what it is about the high trilling, tinkly piano that sets your hairs on end. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't come crashing in on you like the Omen soundtrack with its big rolling thunder kind of sound.
Again, I think it's sort of the foreboding nature of this this sound that's relatively simple. It's relatively easy on the ears, but that the repetition, the drone, I think creates kind of a foreboding sense.
I think you get that in a lot of horror soundtracks.
And I think it's the repetition you'll pick up
on my next one. I'm pretty sure you're gonna.
Okay.
The rumble on the bottom, that there's a lot of separation in the audio for horror soundtracks.
Oh yeah, for sure.
All right, so my number two,
Yes. Your number two on the Fearsome Foursome list. All right, what do you got?
All right.
What do you got?
Minimalism.
All right, let's hear it. This is Valentine's Day.
No.
This is... Wait, give
it a little, because it...
I like what I'm hearing. I like the drone. I like the heavy synth.
You're gonna get more of the synth.
It's not Black Rainbow, which we talked about in the sci-fi horror episode, which is an awesome soundtrack, by the way, if you haven't heard it. Wow. Well, let's keep this one going for give me 15 more seconds. Right. It's not Chud. It's not Altered States. Oh man, this is a head scratcher.
I'll give you a clue.
Okay.
The composer is Ennio Morricone.
Can I phone a friend?
You're on your own, pal.
Ennio Morricone, who did such great stuff. Wow. I give.
This is The Thing.
Oh,
it's my number one.
I knew it.
So.
I knew The Thing was going to be in here somehow, somewhere.
Cold, chilly.
Yes, indeed. Yes, all of it.
And it plays throughout the film. I think that it's it really reinforces the atmosphere of what Carpenter was putting to screen.
Mm-hmm.
It sort of draws you in. One thing that, you know, when we didn't catch the intro, there's a real rise and swell of there's kind of a build right before the spaceship arrives,
right?
And one thing that you see when the opening sequence, it's the helicopter pursuing the dog across the ice,
right?
And it's that kind of that heartbeat of the film, and you're kind of wondering why are they hunting this dog? And then in the background, dum-dum-dum-dum-dum.
Yep.
And then it swells, I think that you asked him what instruments really play well. Eventually, they bring in like piccolos and real high horn or woodwind sections, and really effectively, which is very different than, say, this is again the very drone, very different from the 1950s kind of horror movies.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It borrows this, so this is an early 80s, so you're transitioning, and I think that. I also considered it's not prog,
it's not new wave, no. It's not rock, it's kind of caught in this weird this weird middle ground.
And I think it's a very different, because, you know, Morricone, best known for his westerns,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, Fistful of Dollars and that kind of stuff.
Yep.
But I think it sounds like a Carpenter track.
Because
of its simplicity.
Right.
And I like Carpenter's Prince of Darkness soundtrack, which is similar to this. The Alien soundtrack has similar kinds of that feeling of isolation and the claustrophobia.
There's a sparseness to it.
Yes.
There's definitely a sparseness to it. But it also has the drone of a lot of what we were talking about with Phantasm. It has that sort of, and Zombie too. It has that definite drone, that kind of marching quality, that foreboding quality.
The heavy rhythms.
Mm-hmm.
You don't get a whole lot of samba polyrhythmic kind of things in horror movies. That's not their bag.
No, not at all.
Okay, Campbell. So now that I've chewed up one of yours, have you got another one for me?
I do. This is kind of my number one. Well, I got a couple of number ones, but we'll stick with this
I think I know what I'm up against. Let's go.
All right, Eric. Let's see if you know this one.
All right.
This is a good one.
Volume.
Oh, we got volume.
Okay.
It's a slow build. You gotta stick with it.
I'm pretty sure I know what this is.
Come on.
I can hear the Technicolor. Is this perhaps belonging to an Italian movie?
It is. It belonged to an Italian film, yes.
Would it happen to be directed by Dario Argento?
Oh, yes.
This is without a doubt, one of the famed original orchestrations, but let's let it play for a little while.
Okay.
Bit.
Do you think you know?
It's Suspiria.
No!
Is it not Suspiria?
Oh, no,
come
on! You were so close. It's Deep Red.
Okay, is this also... Did Goblin do this as well?
Goblin did do this. I had to throw some Goblin love. Yeah, this is the opening soundtrack... opening song to Deep Red. Yeah, it was... mainly composed the soundtrack, and it's not just that opening sequence, which is so iconic, but the soundtrack was mainly composed by Goblin. Apparently Argento had originally contacted this Italian jazz pianist Giorgio Gasolini to score the film, but he was apparently unhappy with it, and he deemed the whole thing to be awful. And so then allegedly Argento went after Pink Floyd. He was like, Pink Floyd, we want you to do Deep Red. And for whatever reason, I'm sure there's a million reasons, money might have been one of them. He was unable to get Pink Floyd to score the soundtrack to Profondo Rosso, Deep Red.
I don't think Pink Floyd did, apart from The Wall, they did a sort of
faux hippie psychedelic film from the early 70s.
Was this Saucer Full of Secrets?
No, it's set in Southern California. I'm going to blank on it, but we will hip you to it at some point. I can't think of the name of it. It's not a horror film. But anyway, they didn't get it. So Argento went back to Italy and said, okay, well, this Italian composer didn't do it. I can't get Pink Floyd, so I'm gonna stick with the Goblin, and because Goblin turns out such great stuff. This was pre Suspiria too. So Goblin was only just sharpening their craft.
So this was their audition.
Kind of. Well, yeah. I mean, I think they'd done some earlier stuff. The interesting thing is apparently they were wrongly credited as only musical performers. And
not the composers.
The other guy that they gave the heave-ho to, he got the composer credit.
Oh, it's raw.
Apparently that's been subsequently corrected on subsequent pressings of the DVD and elsewhere. But initially, the initial theatrical release had Goblin getting the stiff arm.
Sad
for the Goblin. And you know what? You can still go out and see Goblin in 2018. Huh. Goblin is still outperforming. I don't know how many of the original Goblins there are. I don't know how many of the original Goblins there were, but you can still see Goblin does live performances.
Is Goblin, are they Italian? Are they British?
Yeah, Italian. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
So there you go. So that's what you call Michael Campbell pulling the rug out from Eric Lee. I was totally waiting for his... Because if you didn't know, Mike has been throwing serious love at the Suspiria soundtrack.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Calling it the best ever since day one. Right, and so
since
I was
day
like,
one.
I overthought that one. I was... he got me. He
all
got
right.
me.
All right.
All right. So, all right. So my number one...
Yes.
No collision here.
All right, I'm curious. Okay. I can't wait for it. Here we
go. All right, so this one is
Eric's number one.
I'll set it up. I'll give you a date.
Okay,
to help you out. This is 1992.
1992.
Not a great year for, not a great decade for horror, but this one.
1992. I know what you did last summer. Truth or Dare. Ooh, this is a puzzler. I like it. It's a little classical-ish.
It is
super classical-ish. This is an original composition.
Original composition by Philip Glass.
Ooh, for a horror film.
For a horror film. So yes.
Oh.
And then wait for the vocals, because then maybe then might cue you in.
Hellraiser.
Nope.
No. Stumped. I am so stumped.
We dare you to say his name five times.
Oh, Candyman.
This is Candyman.
Candyman.
So,
Candyman, where have you been?
Candyman, 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 Candyman. I'm doomed. Okay.
It's interesting. We're 20 episodes in and we have never uttered the words Candyman.
Because it's not a good movie.
We're going to go back and rewatch Candyman.
So, but it's a great soundtrack. And this was the fact that actually a world-renowned modernist minimalist composer like Philip Glass would agree to do a schlock film like Candyman. You were close when you said Hellraiser because Candyman being a Clive Barker story.
Right.
Apparently, Barker had convinced Glass to contribute his work to the movie, and then Glass apparently didn't like the movie. He thought it was going to be a more heady thriller, and it turned out to be a franchise serial killer kind of a schlocky thing. But this is so. What we heard was sort of the opening credits as it rolls in, and I think one thing that separates Philip Glass's music is it sounds synthetic. But the kinds of things that he does with vocal tricks, he can control the sound of his performers to make it sound like the stop and the start and the kind of the hiccup and the backup and the and all the kind of staccato moves that he does, where it's precision music.
Right.
It's really, really tight in a modern way where you feel like there's real clear delineation and separation of each of the instruments, and they come in and out in a way that is kind of uneasy. And I think, though it's pleasant, initially it starts out pleasant, but then you get the kind of the discordal kind of tension in there. And he did Koi on a Scotsie, if you've seen that, which is very much where it's all his stuff, where it's swirling life in chaos kind of stuff. And then he also did The Thin Blue Line.
Right.
Errol Morris. Yeah, so he was...
Errol Morris needs to do a horror movie. No, he doesn't.
I don't know.
No, he doesn't.
I think it would be...
I'm kidding. That would be a horrible idea.
So
horrible, terrible idea.
And I think it's kind of funny that when you look... I was peeking at the 1992 best song original scores.
Uh-huh.
I think they could have, if Candyman wasn't such a shitty movie, they could have put, this would have been a very interesting take on a...
Now, when was the last time you saw Candyman, though?
Oh, God.
Would you see it when it came out?
I saw it in the theater.
I think we should go back and give Candyman a look.
Tony Todd.
Yes.
Let's
go back and give Candyman a look. We'll get back to you on this Candyman thing.
So, I think...
All right.
I think it inspired to a lot, but the movie, The soundtrack was more ambitious than the movie.
Right.
But we'll have to go see it again.
That's right. All right, so those are your favorite soundtracks.
Yeah.
What do you think is the scariest?
I still think Jaws is the scariest.
You're going with Jaws.
Not
going with Tubular Bells. You're going with, just stick with Jaws.
I think The Omen would be number 2.
Yeah. Jaws, Omen.
But
just in terms of that one sort of key pieces of musical phrasing.
I listened to a lot of the John Williams soundtrack and the bottom. It comes in a few moments, but he changes things up the whole soundtrack, and of course it's John freaking Williams, right? It's he weaves in stories within Jaws that are really cool.
Right.
Oh,
sorry.
Speaking of horrifying, was that Candy Crush?
Eric was droning on and on about John Williams, and I had to play Candy Crush, and I... I'm not sure where my head was at there, but, sometimes you just have to take that little bit of reprieve.
Right.
Yeah.
So,
I agree. I think Jaws is right up there.
I think another one that I didn't pick, partly because I didn't want to collide, but I thought I might with you is the Psycho soundtrack.
Oh yeah, that's great. That's also brilliant. Who did that? Do you remember who did that one?
No, I'd have to pause it and IMDb it. But that's another one of those movies. Well, and of course, I think there's a lot of composers who would bend over backwards to work with Hitchcock.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. You know, a great soundtrack, which I teased out last week for this episode on the ScariestThings.com website, is the soundtrack, because I just picked it up. Mm-hmm. I found a used copy of it for $7 in mint condition.
On vinyl,
The Invasion of the Body Snatchers.
That's great.
And the guy that did it, Danny Zeitlin, he was apparently a somewhat famous jazz guy.
Okay.
And this was his first and only foray into soundtracks.
Huh.
And he kind of killed it. Like, there's a lot of different elements in the soundtrack. If you listen to the soundtrack front to back, there's a lot of really, as you put it, very discordant, weird, kind of terrifying sounds. And if you go back and watch Invasion of the Body Snatchers, you'll see that. But then he pulls in some, like, jazz elements and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. But he was definitely a one-and-done guy. He did the soundtrack, and it was so taxing. And he sort of lost creativity as he was doing it, that he just said, I'm kind of done.
Right.
I'm done doing soundtracks. It's a good one. It's a
I
good
have
one.
A fifth one.
Okay.
That we can try bonus round, because we have a little extra time here.
Yes. I do too.
So I'm gonna
throw this one at you and see if you know, because I think this is the scariest soundtrack. I think this is the scariest music of all time. The soundtrack has got all sorts of weird elements, but I'm gonna throw this one at you and see if you can guess.
All right.
Okay, we're jumping right to the middle of the song, because this is a long song. This is a I don't know, 8, 9, 10 minute song. I'm just gonna throw a little bit of Eric and see if you can guess what this
is. Can you throw me a clue?
The greatest director of all time.
This is the greatest director of all time, according to Mike Camp.
And a couple other people.
So it's not Hitch. Is it Hitchcock?
Nope, not Hitchcock.
It's not Spielberg.
Nope.
This is too elaborate for Carpenter.
Oh yeah, way too elaborate, yeah.
Is this Coppola?
No.
Nope. Okay.
Uh-uh.
I thought it might be Dracula Returns.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Oh, Jesus. Oh, is this Kubrick?
Yes. This is, of course, we're talking about Shining? The soundtrack to The Shining. Yeah. I mean, Wendy Carlos, that film to me, I think that might be one of the more complete soundtracks of all time. It's definitely, to me, I mean, it's not one, I wouldn't say it's one of my favorite, because it's almost unlistenable, because it still is so evocative.
Right.
And it's still, even just listening to the soundtrack by itself, non-contextualized to the film, just sitting down and listening to it is still scary. So
actually, because the thing that was beginning to cue me in was the sketchy kind of
That sketchy, and that was part of the reason when I was doing the research, that was why I asked the question about the sketchiness, because I wanted you to answer the question, violin, piano, or synthesizer, because The Shining is all violin. I mean, obviously there's a whole orchestra involved, but the piece that really gets you is that very, very discordant, sketchy, as you put it, violin sound. And that is so disturbing.
When I was a child, I played the violin, and that was the kind of sounds that I would be making. All the scratchy, squitchy stuff, and not the actual, and atonal by accident.
Right, right.
Okay.
You know, the interesting thing about that was that when they did the film, Stanley Kubrick apparently shot, and allegedly there's a longer version kicking around somewhere, but he shot tons of scenes that were never used for the film.
Mm-hmm.
And the first time when he brought Wendy Carlos in and Rachel Elkind, they were shown the original version, which was very long. There was all sorts of other sort of weird, fantastical scenes in the film.
Mm-hmm.
And so they sat down in earnest and scored the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
But then Kubrick, you know, kind of pulled the rug out from under them and was like, no, 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 I'm going with this other version. And apparently Wendy Carlos was so disillusioned that she said she would never, ever work with him again.
I think you can hear that in a lot of people who've had to work with Kubrick. It's a matter of survival.
Right. Right.
Ask Shelley Duvall how she enjoyed her experience doing.
Well, and the interesting thing is that the soundtrack was with, it was withdrawn because of licensing issues.
Oh, really?
And it has technically never been released on CD. Mm. And the vinyl copies of The Shining go for $150-$200. They're almost impossible to lay your hands on. So if you
apparently you can get it digitally.
Yes, you can get it digitally if you poke around long enough. But yeah, look for a digital copy of look for any copy. You can go on mm-hmm. YouTube, but if you find that vinyl copy, snatch that thing up, but quick.
All right. More bonus round.
All right, bonus round. All right, this is bonus round 2.
For something completely different. Okay. Now, this sort of blends into, this might be more song than soundtrack, but
it is. All right, it is, all right. I like it. This is Paul Simon and Art Garfunkel.
And as soon as you figure it out, you go,
this is the Cat Stevens Jethro Tull joint that they did together. This is the Cat Stevens remix with Jethro Tull.
Now, a lot of people will refer to this as one of the great horror soundtracks of all time. And so I was like, how is that? But I listen to it and I go, I remember the movie from this soundtrack.
The Wicker Man.
Yes!
Oh, wow. It was the barley.
Yes!
The barley did it. The barley got me.
So
it was the barley, yes. And that would be, of course, the
Paul
most unscary song of all time. That is at the far other end of the spectrum from Wendy Carlos.
What the hell is a Bonnie Cornrows? I don't know, but this was, I had to throw this in there just as a, it's like total knuckleball. This is not scary.
I hear it. I got to first base.
And yet, you knew what it was from.
I did. It took a second.
There's all this, the hippie dippy Celtic stuff.
When I heard the word barley, I knew it.
Nice. Good job, Michael Campbell.
All right, so I think that wraps up our episode. But before we go, we want to give you our hot takes for the week. This is when we go crate digging. Mm-hmm. This is when we tell you what we found this week. So, Eric, what did you find this week?
Well, I had a lot of this is a particularly fun tidbit, and I did post this on the scariestthings.com website. One T. This apparently in Perth, Australia.
Oh yes.
There was a showing of Peter Rabbit, which is
also not scary. Like the Wicker Man soundtrack.
But it's a it's adorable animals taken from the kindest, sweetest books from Beatrix Potter. And granted, I think that the new take on the show has a lot of kind of slapstick Bugs Bunny level violence on it, which I don't think Beatrix Potter would be particularly fond of. But she really would not have been fond of the trailer that showed up in front of a Peter Rabbit matinee, which was apparently a free day, Anzac Day, which is the Memorial Day in Australia.
Right.
Hey, Aussies, how you doing?
Knew what Anzac Day was.
Yeah. gotta get some bonus points. You guys gonna listen to our podcast, right? They showed Hereditary in front of Peter Rabbit.
And
traumatized,
there was pandemonium.
It was parents freaking out,
parents
to cover
laying
their kids
on top
eyes
of their children,
and
parents covering their ears, picking them up by the scruffs of their neck, and dragging them out of the theater, screaming.
The parents were screaming to make the trailer stop. They had to power down the whole theater because the audience was so scared. And watch the trailer. It's a good, scary trailer. It's like, you ain't seen nothing yet because you haven't seen the movie, and the movie lives up to it. And they should do a double feature, Peter Rabbit.
And the trailer lives up to it. In fact, I showed my 14-year-old the trailer. He made it about, I think the trailer is like 2 minutes and 40 seconds. I'm going to say he made it about 15 seconds in and said, pull the plug, that's it, I'm done.
Not for scaredy cats. I think.
So if it's not for a 14-year-old, it is not for a theater full of children.
7-year-old kids. Anyways, that was, I love that, the that little story that just happened this week.
Yes. All right. So my hot take for the week, my grave digging. I went down into the crypt and I found out that they just did a screening of the new Halloween film coming out next year.
Jamie Lee.
And Jamie Lee Curtis, in a nice little bit of self-promotion, described it as hella scary. She said, "I guarantee this will scare the living H-S-H-I-T out of you." So,
awesome.
We'll see. We'll see. I mean, I'm sure there's a little bit of there's a little bit of self-congratulatory pomp and circumstance going on there, but and there are some, I mean, I know there's some sites out there that claim they have seen the film and claim that the ending is not all that, and they claim that it's not as scary as it is. But there's a lot of people debunking that as well. So I think the vote is still very, very much out on Halloween.
And John Carpenter's directing this one too.
Yeah, he is.
And
yeah.
So you know they're bringing the band back together. In fact, I forget the actor's name, but the guy who played Michael Myers was trying to show that he's still fit enough to do it.
The shape. Band.
Yeah, but he's 70 something years old. He's still but they showed him on a treadmill. If you go into the deep archives of Scariest Things, you will find. The Michael Myers actor attempting to get into shape for the role. I think they might do the Peter Mayhew Chewbacca thing where they put him behind the shape for a couple of scenes, and then when he actually needs to be active and attacking, they'll swap him out for an appropriately young man.
They'll throw some Kane Hodder.
I'm very interested to see actually how they reboot this thing, because my understanding is that they're actually going to it's not a continuation of the story, it's a reboot. Or a remake, and which leads us to one of those things.
It's a continuation of a piece of the story that never existed.
Right. Yeah. And they're gonna wipe out a lot of they're retconning this. They're resetting the dial. And it's like, I don't know if that's a good thing or not.
Yeah,
we'll see. I mean, it's gonna be released on Halloween.
Yep. So vote's still out. We'll be there.
Stay
Hope
tuned.
You will too. But before we go. I want to talk a little bit about a 1983 film called Frightmare, because Frightmare told us there is no escape, not even in death.